Hello, everyone. This is Reva Winkler at the National Quality Forum. Thank you very much for joining us today for this conference call of the Cardiovascular Endorsement Maintenance Steering Committee. To the steering committee members, thank you very much for taking time to join us today. I just wanted to do a quick logistics review. We will be using the agenda that was sent to you 2 days ago on May 9th. It is revised with a couple of new additional measures to be discussed. At the same time with that email, we sent you the same version of the call materials. It's a PDF document that's bookmarked with three memos in it. We'll be working off of those. Those materials are also posted on our website. In addition, a week ago we had sent you the first set of meeting materials, and in that group was a letter from the ACCF, AHA, and PCPI that we will be referring to. So, and as we are discussing the measures, we will be expecting the committee to make some decisions, but we will not be voting on the call. We will use a SurveyMonkey tool that we'll send to you after the call for you to register your votes, and that'll be logistically easier. So with those basic logistics, I'm going to turn it over to Ray and Mary. All right?
Hi, this is Ray. Welcome. Thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedules. Just to let you know, I am doing this call in Washington Reagan Airport, and it is beyond my capabilities to mute and unmute rapidly enough. So you will hear security announcements periodically, and you'll also hear time announcements every 30 minutes. That actually might keep us on schedule. So our task today is pretty ambitious. We will do what we can to get through the agenda, want to allow adequate time. I think for discussion of the important issues. I do think that one of the challenges will be to make sure that everyone is literally on the same page in finding the correct document to refer to as we discuss them. Unfortunately, in terms of the first segment of the agenda, none of the original discussants, primary discussants for these three measures are available for the call. So we will have to make do with the notes and summary of our previous meeting. So the first item is 0073, and that is included in the PDF that went out that's labeled Update Measures. So I want to make sure that everybody finds the right PDF and is with us as we start to tackle that one. It was vascular disease blood pressure management, 0073.
Got it.
Give everybody a minute to make sure that they've got the right item. So this was the item where we deferred action because of several concerns dealing with the measure. One was the blood pressure level of 148/80. Another was the absence of any age limitation. And a third was the fact that in one point in the document there was an exclusion listed for end-stage renal disease, but that was inconsistent in the document.
Right.
So all of those issues were referred back to the actual developer, who came back with responses. And those responses are actually in a separate document that is entitled Deferred Inactive Competing Measures, separate PDF. So if you want to open both PDFs, that might be advisable, but the original is in, as I indicated, one PDF, and the actual responses from the developer are in the other PDF. and the responses appear beginning on page 2 of the second PDF that starts deferred inactive measures. So this is in the deferred measure bookmark. Give everybody a minute to find that, and basically then we'll go through what the developer said. Okay, so I hope everybody can find that. So the developer basically said in response to our questions, what's the evidence for the less than 140 over 80 target? They withdrew it. And we'll continue with the target of less than 140 over 90 with the intention of reviewing or revising when JNC 8 is released in 2012. And they went into various and sundry other comments about that, but I think the important thing is they switched to 140 over 90. We also raised concern about the absence of an upper age limit, and they basically said there's no simple rule, pointed out that these things should be harmonized, but only after sort of evaluation with multiple other developers, so they didn't propose one. The other question we raised was home blood pressure values, the fact that they weren't accepted, and they basically indicated that their advisory group thought there was a significant problem with respect to standardization, how to correlate these measurements to those obtained in randomized trials in the office, and were willing to open again for consideration only after full testing of feasibility and reliability, including blood pressure monitoring and home blood pressure measurement. And then lastly, I think the important thing where we raised some concern about the exclusions regarding end-stage renal disease, they corrected that and added exclusions for end-stage renal disease, pregnancy, and admission to a non-acute inpatient facility. So those were their responses, comments, or discussion about their responses.
Well, my initial response to their response is that they seem to have, for the most part, accepted our observations. And I think that was what we were looking for, pretty much. I guess the big question is whether the area in which they said, well, they didn't think so, whether that should be enough for us to withhold.
Approval.
Cool.
Other comments? And I should say, in terms of, although I think I can recognize voices pretty well, as you comment, please identify yourself.
I'm sorry, this is Snow, Boston.
Yeah, I knew. Appreciate that. Thanks.
Is that because I just spilled some coffee?
Right. Other thoughts about this? And in particular, I welcome any thoughts about the age cutoff question.
This is Mary, and I just had a question in regard to the age cutoff, whether the 2011 consensus document on hypertension in the elderly gives us any guidance on that.
Well, I think there's been a literature review published that Sid Smith pointed out at the meeting. I think there has been a recognition that the randomized trials in the elderly often started way above 140 over 90 in terms of pretreatment, and then the treatment groups did not get to 140 over 90. I think the other issue that everybody should be aware of is we did approve the optimal vascular care measure from Minnesota that has an upper age limit of 75 to avoid the controversy.
This is Tom Kotke. I think, you know, the individualization of care after 75 becomes much more important, and I think that's I think what we did with the Minnesota Community Measurement is pretty reasonable.
So one possibility would be go back to the developer and say, we've approved the measure. They've indicated their desire to harmonize, open to harmonizing the measure with 0076. All they said was most specifications must be carried out in a careful and deliberate manner since changes can affect both trendability as well as completeness, accuracy, and reliability of data collection. I think if we asked them to harmonize with 0076 and instead age 75, that would be one approach, realizing that JNC8 may then come out early next year and clarify the age issue.
This is Dion, Jewel. From an implementation standpoint, given that the guidelines we think are going to be out early next year, if the measure is endorsed now with 75 as the cutoff, what happens practically? Does it wait for review again to see whether they've adopted the new guideline, if there is a new threshold, or do they have to implement that new threshold immediately?
This is Reva. Once the new guidelines come out, depending on what they say, will impact what measure developers may or may not do. All measure developers are expected to provide us with annual updates, and we would certainly, since we have raised this as an issue, expect as part of that update to be responsive to the new JNC8 guidelines.
Okay. And both of these developers, both Minnesota Community Measurement and CQA, have indicated that they're going to be.
Right. I just didn't know from an actual practical implementation standpoint how the measure would, if the measure would itself be altered for reporting purposes in order to do that adoption, even if they wanted to, or if they'd have to wait.
We can certainly address that in an expeditious manner, particularly since we're waiting for it and expecting it.
Okay. Well, I'd be inclined to go along with the prior recommendation that we suggest to them that 75 be the cutoff until we see the guideline.
Other thoughts about that? Are there major objections to that? Everybody's going to get a chance to vote, but not on the call. Are there other thoughts about this that we should subsequently vote on?
Hi, this is Bruce. So, just so I understand the main. It seems like they've addressed everything except for that one issue where they said we don't agree or something like that.
Ambulatory, yeah. They've just flat out disagreed on that. And they did not put, they have no age cutoff.
Okay.
And when we raised it, they said, yeah, it's important, everybody should discuss it. But they also said they're willing to harmonize with 0076, which has an age cutoff of 75.
Now, of the three issues, I think the ambulatory is the one where their position is most defensible because at clinical level, getting ambulatory measurements, I always have found to be very valuable. I don't diss it at all, but from the standpoint of having a measure and the things that a measure needs, comparability of the data becomes kind of important, and with an individual person, the internal consistency of how some guy measures his blood pressure, even though it may not be accurate exactly, is kind of drops out of the equation. So if there were a place to give, that's the one where I would go along with them and accept their position. From the standpoint that this is a measure, because I don't think it's as clinical as it is, I don't think that that's the entire story.
Okay, are there any other thoughts? Otherwise, I'm going to propose that we simply vote on approval without ambulatory blood pressures and with an age cutoff of 75, realizing that we expect JNC8 will have something to say about that issue early next year.
Okay.
Is that acceptable? Are there concerns about that?
Sounds good to me. This is Tom Kopke.
Me as well.
Okay. Let's move ahead then to the next two. And these are both, I think it's important, these are both addressed in the letter from ACCF, AHA, and PCPI. That is one of the other attachments that Reva mentioned. The letter was dated May 3rd. It was addressed to me and in my capacity as chair. And I want to make sure everybody gets that letter out. The pertinent part of the letter begins with a subheading at the bottom of page one that says considerations regarding measures for hypertension, where PCPI basically attempts to justify their use of a target blood pressure or at least two antihypertensive medications. Something that we were concerned about. They include an article, or attached an article and quoted from that article, and I think the quote is actually, I think you can look at the quote both ways. It says, many blacks, 28%, and whites, 34%, with blood pressure above goal, had fewer than two antihypertensive drug classes prescribed. So that's the data they cite. But I would point out that from that same data, presumably that means that 72% of the blacks and 66% of the whites with blood pressure above goal had, in fact, two or more antihypertensive drug classes prescribed. So this measure, as they proposed it, would presumably, therefore, only identify a minority of those with blood pressure above goal. So I think the gist of this, and everybody can read it, but the gist of it is that they want their measure needed to avoid adverse consequences and be feasible, and they were concerned that the feasibility of a measure that required three or more antihypertensives. As I recall our discussion and what I saw in their paragraph, one point that was explicitly raised in our discussion is the way this measure was framed. Somebody could have a blood pressure of 220 over 120 on very minimal doses of two antihypertensives, and that would be okay.
Right.
And they don't address that in their response.
Ray, did you want to see if anyone is on the line from PCPI
yes,
to comment?
PCPI?
Yes, John Spertus, can you hear me?
John, yeah, sure, go.
So, you know, you clearly hold out sort of an extreme example of somebody with a blood pressure of 220 over 140 on small doses of two antihypertensive medicines. And our concern, and we spent a tremendous amount of time discussing how to feasibly collect this, was that, you know, if somebody is at that level, you know, some patients are very hard to control their blood pressures for intolerance to certain classes of agents or for other reasons. And, you know, we ended up selecting two medicines as opposed to three or more antihypertensive medicines because it would signal that there was a significant intent to try and control the blood pressure. And we didn't want to have patients with poorly controlled blood pressure, somebody who, you know, was it 150 over 100 and couldn't tolerate more medicines to be, quote-unquote, dinged for not, you know, getting good quality care. And the converse was to try and figure out from a data collection sheet or an EMR and second-guess the clinician who was in the room to, you know, whether or not they had used the right technique or really pushed some of the medicines as much as they could have. We thought that would be very difficult because you couldn't tell whether higher doses or additional medicines had been tried in the past and had been intolerable by the patient. And so we really were concerned in striking a balance to find a threshold where it really suggested that there was an intent to try to control blood pressure without being in the position of second-guessing whether they couldn't have done better. And so that's why anybody who's successful with one, two, or more medicines and does have a blood pressure below 140 over 90 for that patient would be considered having provided good quality care for that patient's antihypertensive control. If they did not need that, but they had at least, you know, were putting patients on multiple medications, we felt that at this point in time, given the current state of records, that was the best, most fair way to balance a significant effort to control the blood pressure while also not being in a position to perhaps inappropriately judge whether other efforts have been tried and they currently were on only two medicines. So that was the logic behind that. And it extends our previous measures had been, which is just, was there a plan of action, which was very vague and amorphous and, you know, could have, we felt was inadequate to start to get at the need to be emphasizing attaining blood pressure control or making even a stronger effort to control it.
Other comments or questions from the committee for John?
Tom Kotke here. I'm a little torn between the, you know, the expertise of my clinical colleagues and the debate, which I want to respect, but and the my feeling that, I mean, two drugs is like 12.5 of hydrochlorothiazide and you know, a little bit of ACE and a little bit of beta blocker, and you know, I think that my typical patients are on four drugs. They're on some diuretic, they're on some ACE and beta blocker, and probably some amlodipine. I guess I would say, okay, the ACC, their intention, you know, the ACCF, that they thought this through, their intentions are right. They had a very hefty discussion about it. They are pushing the science forward by saying, hey, you don't need just a plan. You need to actually prescribe some drugs. And so I guess I would vote to endorse the measure, recognizing that as this is thought out, they'll probably keep pushing for the science and the measurement forward.
And I would say we definitely intend to do that, Tom. And, you know, I mean, a lot of patients are on, you know, much higher doses of these medicines. I mean, they could be on, you know, 200 a day of beta blockers and, you know, a high dose of ACE and they could have more medicines. I mean, this would credit anybody who had somebody on three or four medicines. What it would really ding is somebody, we just felt there were enough medication options for the control of blood pressure that if you were on only one medicine and you were not controlled, that was inadequate. And, you know, there's no limit to how much, and I don't think that we should presume that doctors are going to try and just meet the measure by giving homeopathic doses of two different classes or two different agents. It's, you know, they're really trying to get the blood pressure under control, and they haven't just stopped at one medicine. They've prescribed more.
So I think it's just in terms of getting everybody to look at all the right documents, since we didn't have the primary reviewer available, the NQS staff on Tuesday morning, I believe, at 10:20 a.m. sent an email which has the summary of our votes the last time on this measure, which was 4013, where just to remind everybody, importance was 19-1 yes, scientific acceptability was 3 complete, 5 partial, 8 minimal, 5 no, usable was 5 complete, 9 partial, 6 minimal, 1 no. Feasibility, complete 9, partial 6, minimal 5, no 0. And the vote for endorsement was 6 yes and 15 no. So if you found that email, I've tried to just highlight it in case you haven't, because we have a lot of different documents. So basically, the PCCF, AHA, and PCPI are asking us to revisit this earlier vote and have given this response, and John has just addressed some of the issues. So are there other questions for John or discussion, realizing that then we'll have a subsequent mail ballot revoting on this?
This is Mary, and this, I guess, is to the developers. What data do you have to show that this change to this type of measure will have an impact on the control among treated hypertensive patients?
Well, it's difficult to know, you know, what did, I mean, there's, you know, we can go back and do cross-sectional analyses or actually longitudinal analyses comparing those on multiple meds versus one and provide that data to you separately from, you know, about 500,000 patients from Pinnacle. But, you know, the challenge is that you're asking if you raise the bar, because that's just going to be an association, and it's going to be confounded by the fact that some patients are not going to have great control, and that's why they're on the multiple medications. And if you want to know what's the impact of, you know, sort of increased accountability for more aggressive antihypertensive control on subsequent blood pressure control, that's never been tested. I mean, we've never had a performance measure. A lot of this is to develop those performance measures and then to study whether that drives better blood pressure control over time. And as we enter an age of increasing accountability and increasingly titrate the scrutiny of the quality of care for blood pressure management, I think we'll have that data. But right now, it hasn't existed. And if we do the analysis within Pinnacle, I just am concerned by confounding that patients will have higher blood pressure controls who are on more medicines, and they're on the more medicines because they have tougher to control blood pressures, not that, you know, having more medicines is associated with worse blood pressure control. We do feel that this is advancing what we had before, which was just an amorphous plan of action that was previously endorsed, and we feel that's too low a bar.
This is Andrea Russo. I'm sorry, I was very late on the getting on the call, but I guess, was there any thought, I guess the two or more to me, was there any thought of having three or more antihypertensive medications? Because a lot of people, I'm just thinking of specific scenarios where I've seen patients, particularly they might have heart failure, they might have coronary disease, but they might be on a little bit of an ACE inhibitor, a little bit of a beta blocker, and people aren't paying as much attention to the blood pressure as they should be. How did you decide on the two or more drugs? To me, if you had three in there, it would be, you know, a no-brainer. You know, that would be you're really trying. But I wonder with two, a lot of people are on two and thinking of an ACE inhibitor plus beta blocker combination. So was that based on anything in particular or just arbitrary?
It was based on as you increase the number of medicines, you know, patients will be and have been tried on other classes of medicines in the past and might be intolerant. And, you know, this was the best judgment of a consensus of experts who, you know, I mean, this was a very hotly debated issue. I mean, there were people as fervent about primary prevention as Tom Cochrane, including David Goff and others that were on this measure, this group, or I may have the wrong committee, but in any event, you know, this was a heated discussion over multiple, I think it was Don Casey that was advocating very strongly for higher levels. And you know, we ultimately, you know, felt that this was the best first step. And we would like to, you know, if we learn this is not adequate and need to increase it further and keep raising the bar, that's good. But this was significantly raising the bar over where it had been, and we thought that it did indicate a real effort. And if they have other comorbidities that, you know, get prescribed the same class of medicines, that even further underscores the importance of controlling blood pressure. One would just only, you know, hope that the doctors would be trying to do it. You're really trying to capture here people who are not giving adequate attention to blood pressure control. And I think there are a lot of patients, and it differs a little bit by rates, that, you know, are not well controlled and are not even on two medicines. I mean, if we just got those third of a patient of blacks and a quarter of whites who have poor blood pressure control and are on less than two medicines to be on two or more medicines, you would probably make a huge impact.
And I guess I'm just trying to, you know, I see your point, and I just wonder if maybe the frequency of follow-up visits, because it, you know, most or the majority, I guess, of patients, you might bring them back sooner, increase their medicines, and then you might get to a third pretty quickly. You know, if you only have two visits.
That's absolutely right. And this is to hopefully draw attention to the issue and incentivize exactly that kind of behavior.
This is Rochelle, and I was just wondering, what's the downside of actually using the blood pressure target, like a, you know, the goal, say, for example, 140 over 90, as opposed to doing it in this sort of, like, sort of little step?
So we were very concerned. For example, nephrologists see very refractory patients with very refractory hypertension. And a nephrologist who had a patient on five antihypertensive medicines and still could not get their blood pressure below 140 over 90 would look like they were delivering bad care, even though it's humanly the best care possible that that patient could receive. And we didn't want to create that adverse consequence such that, you know, patients with really tough-to-control hypertension couldn't get care because nobody wanted to look so terrible, and they're just really tough to handle. And so we created a double-barreled success for the numerator, attaining good blood pressure control, whether that was, you know, just with diet or exercise or you know, minimal pharmacologic interventions, or that there was an evidence of a substantial commitment to trying to use pharmacotherapy to control the blood pressure. And that's why we came up. We didn't leave it at just blood pressure.
Then I think what you're trying to accomplish there, then, it seems like the types of physicians that you're trying to help with this would be those specialists that are really trying many different antihypertensives and probably have maxed out on many of them. And so if that's your goal, maybe you should raise the bar on that part of the measure. In terms of not only the number of drugs, but also the doses that they're pushing the drugs to, like, you know, what percentage of the maximum dose.
Right. Well, we thought about maximum doses, and we felt that it can be very difficult to know whether, you know, a patient was intolerant of higher doses or not, that the burden of that kind of, that detailed data collection exceeded the feasibility of the measure, and that's why we didn't look at actual doses or percent of maximal doses, because there's a lot of interpatient variability that would be very hard to capture, and to capture validly. I mean, how do you even know that they are really intolerant or not? What somebody might consider intolerance, another would not feel that way. And so we felt that was a very difficult variable to capture. I forgot what the other part of your question was. I'm sorry. That's why we didn't do maximal doses. Oh, and
right.
Then, you know, two or three, I mean, look, if the committee came back and uniformly said you had to pick three, that's, you know, fine. We could revisit that with our committee. But, you know, ultimately we're all just, you know, guessing, and we're putting forth one, you know, one threshold versus another. And there were people who argued just as articulately as you that we should have raised the bar, and there were others who, you know, felt that this was indicating a significant effort of the clinician to control blood pressure using at least two medicines. They could certainly use three or four and get credit for it, but if they used just two, was that bad care? And, you know, we ultimately came down at two as the threshold, but, you know, I think that our opinion is similar to your opinion, and in a different task force on this committee might think two was fine, or there might think four was needed. And I just, you know, think we should recognize the limits of creating these measures. And at this point, you know, we felt that there was, you know, two was reasonable, and there is good evidence that, you know, 28% of blacks and 34% of whites who are not at 140 over 90 are not on even two medicines. And so, you know, all those patients would be considered to be getting bad care by this measure.
Tom Kotke, and I think, you know, we have to remember the distribution of blood pressure. If we can get patients on two medications, we're going to probably get the majority of patients. And, And I think it behooves us to resist the urge to try to get the outlier patient in under the tent. I think we ought to support the ACCF recommendation, and knowing full well that they're going to push the bar forward anyway. They're a bunch of aggressive people.
Are there other questions or comments on this one? Because I think we've given it plenty of time, but we must move forward in terms of the agenda.
Yeah. I'll go along with what Tom said. Snow here.
Okay, so...
we'll include it in the ballot for a revote.
Yeah, we will be revoting on this this measure. Now we're going to move on to the other request from PCPI, which dealt with the two different measures, 0065 and 0077. There's a separate section in the paragraph, in the letter about them, consideration regarding patient-centric outcome measures for CAD and heart failure. And these were basically dealing with symptoms. So, John, do you want to come in on them?
Sorry, I was on mute. This measure failed on importance, and, we were a little struck sort of understanding that, but NQF launched, your first face-to-face meeting with a very strong interest in getting to outcomes and in understanding disparities. And there is a lot of evidence that the symptom control of blacks is worse than whites, and that quality of life, symptom control is one of the two primary outcomes of treating anybody with cardiovascular disease. They come to us for care to either live longer or feel better. And a lot of these patients are symptomatic, and those that are symptomatic want alleviation of their symptoms by whatever mechanism, medicines, lifestyle changes, revascularization, et cetera. And so it is really, we think, moving the bar forward to start to include outcomes, particularly patient-centered outcomes. And so we feel this is a very, very important measure. And if you agree that understanding that this is important, then we sort of view two levels. Originally, the NQF had endorsed the clear, explicit documentation in a reproducible way of symptoms and activity levels for patients with coronary disease and heart failure. And we had two measures that we brought forth originally. One was that same measure that had been originally endorsed, and the second was then to look at the results of that measure in order to be able to look at the control across time. We ultimately withdrew the last one because we had not done all of the preliminary testing on that, although there is lots of evidence in the literature that there's enormous variability in symptom control, and I think we included a paper from over 200 clinics in Australia that documented extraordinary variability in the presence of weekly angina in primary care clinics' offices, and that the clinician assessment of that did not correlate with it, and that there, our feeling is that if this first measure, just that it's systematically documented, were accepted by the committee, that we would then be able to go to the next step and bring forth data showing that there is variability and lots of opportunity for improvement by holding physicians accountable for the health status of their patients, their symptoms and their function, and create a way for this very sort of relevant patient-centered outcome to start being quantified and also used as a tool for eradicating disparities. And so, this measure never got the full voter consideration because it wasn't considered important. And, I feel that if you, I can't remember the number from the Jack article, but almost 32% of encounters in the Pinnacle Registry did not have accurate documentation of symptoms and function. And, you know, there's an enormous gain to be made by having that go up to 100%. And that will then lay the foundation for really looking at the results of those assessments in a systematic way. And I guess the one last thing is that that you want to eventually get to efficiency and appropriateness, and this will be, again, a very important application of symptom control is looking at appropriateness, and this will be a very good foundation for supporting those goals of the NQF as well.
Ray, this is Reva. I'd just like to remind the committee that in terms of the measure evaluation criteria, there really is a distinction between things that are important and NQF's importance to measure and report. And I just want to remind the committee that the importance criteria focuses on three parts. One is the impact, two is the opportunity for improvement, and three is the evidence of relationship of the process of care being measured to outcomes. And that is what we need the committee to evaluate the measure against.
And can I just address those? The opportunity for, I forgot what the first one was. The second was opportunity for improvement. And we provided an article showing in a survey of consecutive patients tremendous variability in opportunity for improvement. And, you know, to say relationship to outcome, I mean, this is the outcome. I mean, the outcome controlling patient symptoms. That's what they come to the doctor to get treated for. They want their angina controlled, their shortness of breath controlled. So I think, and what was the first one, Reva?
Impact.
You know,
impact.
And impact is how defined?
Number of patients, morbidity, intent of morbidity. It can be defined any number of ways.
So, you know, 100% of patients with coronary disease are at risk for angina. After a myocardial infarction, about 20 to 25% at 1, 6, and 12 months after an MI still have residual angina. You know, it's skewed. You know, the other 75% are asymptomatic but at risk for developing recurrent angina. In heart failure, the patients are more symptomatic, and there's even greater impact because not asymptomatic, sort of just LV dysfunction, but once they get a diagnosis of heart failure, the heart failure syndrome, that's a much greater burden of their lifestyle. I think it's very impactful. It's sort of why they come to get care is because it's having a big impact on their lives.
And this is Karen Pace. Just for clarification, but the measure is the process of administering the tool, right, not the actual scores on the symptoms?
Right, so I tried to clarify that. So there's currently a real gap in the systematic documentation of symptoms and activity in outpatient charts of patients with coronary disease and heart failure. It's very common to say symptom stable or not even to, you know, address it at all. And so this is trying to come up with applying the Canadian Cardiovascular Society classification or the New York Heart or even for those practices particularly motivated, a more standardized assessment of symptoms and function, and that be reproducibly documented in the chart. And then the second measure that we withdrew because we didn't have enough data to support it was what the actual results of that assessment were.
Ray, this is Bob Bono. I've been listening in to John Spertus, and he's been carrying the ball so well that I felt no reason to say anything other than I think he's made the point very, very clearly that how important this would be for the heart failure measure as well as the CAD measure.
So since we don't have the primary discussant, I want to refer everybody back to the email again from Tuesday morning, at least in terms of 0065. The original discussion is summarized in that email with four bullet points from the staff. Reflecting our earlier discussion, we do not have the primary discussant available for the call.
So this is Dion Jewell. I think if my memory is on target, at least to where my head was when we discussed this back in February, the challenge for me in the measure specification is that I appreciate the need to prompt providers to assess and to document what the assessment is, but the lack of a link even to action of some kind, regardless of what the results of that assessment might be, is a place where I struggle, because we also, there are plenty of data out there, for instance, about the lack of referral to cardiac rehab for quite eligible individuals. And there are lots of reasons why that lack of referral happens, but some piece of that is documented to be, you know, in the hands of the clinician or the provider who could make the referral. So I guess I would feel better about the measure as specified if it at least had a statement that identified a link to some form of action in response to the assessment. So I think that's where my head was when we spoke in February, and I would say it's still there.
So,
can I ask other committee members if you have comments?
Snow here. That's a problem for me too. I would agree that this is, it really looks more like a process measure than an outcome measure. There's so many flips between the cup and the lip there. I'd like to see it linked better to outcomes somehow.
So again, I would just reiterate that it is an outcome. That patient symptom control is the outcome of the care you've given for that underlying disease.
And but you're not indicating anything that suggests that they're controlled. They're just documenting what they are.
Interventions that a cardiologist or a family practitioner or internist would have at their disposal, whether it's titrating medications, whether it's referral to a specialist for further evaluation, whether it's coronary revascularization, in the case of heart failure, consideration of intracardiac devices such as biventricular pacers. There are a range of actions that come from significant symptoms that warrant, but to delineate each of those, that has to be very much individualized to each of the patients. And but it is such bread and butter to the practicing cardiologist and to the internist who deals with a lot of these patients, they do when they do in fact identify that patients have significant symptom burdens, that we didn't link it to it. And, you know, again, our ultimate goal is to be able to report out the actual control so that you could look at best practices and compare how those practices are linking, are doing compared to practices that aren't doing as well. And ultimately, there could be lots of algorithms, automatic referrals every year to a cardiologist in a big multi-specialty practice with an EMR when they found that patients had class 3 angina or greater, or class 3 heart failure or greater, just to make sure they have adequate access to specialty care.
Okay. And so this is Dion Jewell again. I agree with you that it would be unwieldy to try to identify all the possible permutations on a response to the assessment. My point was simply to say that if the measure specification indicated that a response was in the note, or whatever it has to be indicated, and we have other measures that are like that now, where a standardized assessment was completed and a plan of care was developed. To me, that at least gets us on the road toward outcomes beyond just did the provider take the assessment, yes or no. So that was really my point, not to make it such a cumbersome measure that nobody could reasonably do it, but just to really link it more to something beyond the provider, that they actually did something that might impact the patient beyond just collecting the data.
I guess I feel, this is Andrea, I don't have a problem with this particular measure. I think, you know, I do think, and in fact in Pinnacle, I can't believe that's not 100% because that's a motivated group. You know, maybe people are just not documenting it, but I could see people go in the room and say, do you have chest pain, but not really asking what's your level of activity, how far can you, you know, walk. You know, I hate to say it, but I wonder if there really is a gap here and how much people are, you know, you hate to think that this is pretty basic, that if it's not, and if we measure it for 1 year we measure it for 3 years or whatever it is, and it's 100%, then, you know, then it goes away or it gets, I think coupling it with, whether you consider it process or outcome, if you couple it with another type of outcome or plan part of the measure, is great. But is it bad the way it is? And you know, I don't really have problems with this one. I think it would be interesting, actually. It would be, if it's not close to 100%, why isn't it?
But isn't that part of the pre-measure evaluation that is in the hands of the developers in the first place?
But why?
That data to us?
But they wrote down here, Pinnacle, is this right? Is the general perception of the clinicians not doing as well? Pinnacle data is only 85%. And Pinnacle, you know, participants are really motivated, I think, to be able to, and they're only 85. I wonder if the rest of the country is more like 50%.
All right. I see your point. Thank you.
So I actually think if we're not asking, maybe we're not all asking that. We're running in and out, maybe asking half of the question.
I think this time, Kathy, again, one of the questions that's not asked here is level of satisfaction with current physical work capacity and with symptoms. I mean, it doesn't say, you know, did the patient want to do something about this? I have a lot of patients who have some chest pain from time to time or who have some shortness of breath, probably mostly because they're obese, but who don't, you know, are pretty satisfied with where they are and do not choose to pursue further diagnostics or interventions. And I guess I don't understand how that's taken into account by this measure.
I think we're going into
the measure actually a comment, you know, would give credit, for example, in coronary disease for the CCS class, which does not address that, or the use of the Seattle Angina Questionnaire, which does get much more detailed in their satisfaction with care, their quality of life, their perception, their quality of life, et cetera. The same thing with heart failure. We have the NYHA, which is a ubiquitous, simple-to-administer scale that does not get at those issues, and the KCCQ, which explicitly has domains to capture those issues. So, you know, our hope was to ask for a standardized assessment, but that seemed very impractical to do. And the assignment of CCS class or New York Heart class seems to be something that would be much more feasible. So it's, again, accepting good, but feeling that, you know, perfect would be the enemy of getting anything done. And so that's why that was the logic behind accepting both of those. But you raise a very good point, and we would like to see those kinds of standardized assessments used much more often.
And I think it would be interesting to know, we all think this is so basic and, 100, you know, why isn't everyone doing it all the time? But I wonder, I really question, you know, maybe it's some of the basics aren't being done, and then, you know, people need to ask before we can go the next step.
I mean, in anecdotal stories, that's exactly right. And Joe Messer, who's a very experienced clinician, who was one of the co-chairs of the group when we first proposed this back in 1999, I think, went back to his charts and looked at his own charts and found that he had not documented this adequately and started documenting it much more after sort of being privy to this discussion, and that it just isn't documented or documented well, so that what happens is that if one doctor's out of town and another doctor picks up the chart and it's not documented, this patient's always been in class 3 angina, and all that's been documented is angina stable, et cetera, we end up feeling that, you know, they would admit that patient in the hospital for doing much worse all of a sudden. And so there really was felt to be a need in clinical practice to clearly document the symptoms and activity of our patients.
John, wouldn't they ask the patient if things had changed?
Well, you know, I mean,
I wouldn't admit that patient.
I mean,
I'd ask him, has anything changed?
Let Tom finish, please, John. All right? You were going to say something. Have we lost Tom?
What? No, I'm there.
Okay, you were starting. You were just complete your thought.
It says that. I mean, I don't think it necessarily. I mean, that the argument can be, you know, that if I saw one of my colleagues' patients, the patient says, "I have chest pain when I walk to the mailbox." I mean, my next question would be, you know, is this new? Not, gee, when can we get you to the cath lab? I mean, maybe he has to go to the cath lab if it's new, but. So I think the argument that putting down the Canadian classification would solve the problem. I don't. I just don't buy that argument.
I'm not trying to overstate it. I'm just the feeling was that it was not accurately documented in a clear fashion, and it made it difficult to be able to eventually look at the control of symptoms, which is our long-term goal because it's a relevant outcome. And so if we could systematically have this documented in all patients, then the measure that we withdrew will start to have greater opportunity to impact care by looking at the actual success in controlling patient symptoms.
Okay, are there other comments from the committee? All right, so we're going to, I would suggest at this point we've had a very lengthy discussion about this, and that we will simply re-ballot everybody on 0065. Now, Riva, I see a process issue that the letter actually also dealt with 0077.
Yes. And the question, I guess I would say to the committee, you're right, I didn't differentiate the two. It sounds like the issues were very similar and were talked about together. Do you want to revote both of those measures?
I think if we do that, we should at least distribute to the committee the summary of the votes on 0077.
Will do.
In a subsequent email. Are there other comments? We've had the discussion about angina, and the letter deals with both angina and heart failure. So are there other comments? Are there members of the committee who feel that we should have a more extended discussion on another occasion about 0077 before revoting on that? Let me ask it that way. Let me get a sense from everybody.
0077 is heart failure?
Yes.
Yeah. As distinguished from angina.
I think we've had the discussion.
I'd like to thank
John and that group for their hard work, no matter what the outcome is, but implore them to keep on pushing.
Are there others who feel that we need to have a separate discussion on 0077? Okay, Riva, I would suggest, therefore, we distribute to the committee members in a subsequent email the actual summary of the original discussion on 077, and we re-ballot that one at the same time.
Okay, will do.
All right. Thank you, John and Bob. We're going to have to move on now to the topic of competing and related measures. And I would point out to everybody, in terms of finding the right document to open up, that these are the key summaries and tables are in the PDF that's labeled deferred, inactive, competing measures. So if you go to the bookmark on competing measures, you will be where you need to be. And we discussed the competing measures in phase one, which included 0076, which is the optimal vascular care from the Minnesota Community Measurement Project, 0073, which was the blood pressure management issue from NCQA, which has already been discussed today, then we also discussed the antiplatelet and lipid control measures. And we asked the committee we asked the NQF to prepare a list of pros and cons. And that actually appears on the... at that bookmark that I mentioned on competing measures. So the pros, which largely reflected our discussion about having a single composite measure, focuses on several factors that are important in an individual patient, more challenging but important and patient-focused. Second pro is it reduces the number of measures and eliminates redundancy. The third is that it eliminates the need for harmonization of multiple measures. The fourth is that it conserves what we call opportunity costs. We also talked about the need to consolidate measures across conditions, which is also listed there. And the CSAC has been pushing for more challenging, broad, patient-focused measures, which this certainly is. And significant harmonization is needed if we preserve individual measures. The cons are summarized as well. And for those who might not have found the right document, the individual measures such as blood pressure control or aspirin use are important for end users as standalones. The individual components of the community measurement project haven't been evaluated really as standalone measures. The lack of uniform availability of electronic platform at this point in time necessitates maintenance of measures that depend on different data sources. The individual measures have been endorsed for several years and are in use in many large programs, such as CMS's PQRS and the NCQA HEDIS, and those current uses are listed in a table, and some of them have already been retooled for as e-measures for the meaningful use program. Reva, do you want to comment at all on the pros and cons analysis?
No, I think that to paraphrase a discussion we had with Helen Burstyn the other day, I mean, I think that NQF's ultimate goal, if we could have exactly what we want, is we would like to see a composite measure with individual components that could be used as standalones, all specified for EHRs. We're not there yet. But we would really like to see our portfolio of measures move in that direction. And so all of these pros and cons kind of play into that to a greater or lesser degree.
Are there questions or comments about the pros and cons of having a single composite or individual and a single composite and not endorsing the individual measures versus a composite and endorsing the individual measures, which is really the first issue here?
Ray Thomas, point of information, if the in the composite, each of the individual measures would undergo the same scrutiny as they would as if they were individual measures. Is that not correct?
Yes, Tom. They would, to be individual measures as opposed to the component, they would end up having separate submissions and separate evaluations. As it is now, Minnesota does report out the individual measure component values along with the composite, and that's fine, but the bundle goes together and isn't broken apart.
What I was just sort of asking was the diligence of with which each of the – I think we had a little bit of anxiety about the validity or the diligence with which some of the individual components of a component measure were documented.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I was just wondering if we had a composite measure, would we require that all of the components be able to stand on their own?
No, we don't require that, nor do we require them to be individually endorsed. We expect that as part of your evaluation, you will evaluate the individual components.
Okay.
I'm sorry, with the composite measures, and I think you said this, but let me just make sure I heard it correctly. They would so that they would be, it be reported, each of the individual results of individual measures would still be reported to the site as regarding the results of that particular component of the measure. So if you're doing poorly on one of the components, you'll know that where you need to work and improve. Is that correct? That's correct. Okay, but you won't necessarily, right, I'm just trying to think, is there any other, so the negative, so if they're being looked at in terms of disparities, if there's disparities in one of the components, would it be apparent, because it may not be a disparity in overall in the composite measure, would we be able to get at it, that kind of information or not?
I think that will depend on how it's implemented. That's really getting into significant implementation reporting. Detail.
Yeah. This is Bruce. I have a quick question. I just want to make sure I understand that. Someone briefly mentioned that you don't, if you have a composite measure, that each of the components do not necessarily need to be able to stand on their own. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Yeah, I thought we had some discussion in the past about wanting the individual measures to stand, but maybe I misunderstood. For instance, there was some discussion when we met in person about the tobacco status issue and that there were some shortcomings of that or something like that. But that you could have a composite measure that incorporated that even though there were problems with it.
Well, I think you're confusing it with the smoking cessation measure that was part of the hospital measure set for AMI pneumonia and heart failure, which are very problematic and were the endorsement on those was removed. But this particular measure actually, in the composite, the smoking component is whether the patient is a non-smoker or not, and actually NQF does not have an individual measure of that particular type for smoking.
So, Bruce, does that help?
Yeah, I guess it helps. I used the wrong example, but what if we had a component where there was no gap really involved in that component of the measure? It was very close to 100%. You could still have a composite. Everyone would feel comfortable having a composite incorporated such a component.
I mean, that's one of the decisions the steering committee makes, but it is not a requirement that the components are independently endorsed.
But I think it's worth pointing out, Bruce, that that's one of the arguments for composite measures.
Reva, this is Kathy with a question. There would be no weighting of the individual measures within the composite.
This is an all-or-none composite. So
all-or-none, okay.
There's no weighting.
No weighting. Okay, thank you.
Hi, this is Devora. From a public reporting point of view, I think to the consumer, in some ways, it would be, the composite is very nice, it's one number, but it would also be interesting to know, well, okay, they're not doing that well, where are they falling short? So I guess I would be interested in seeing for the composite if it could be reported that the breakdown, you know, kind of behind the scenes for people who are interested.
That's the intention in that, and we asked Minnesota to clarify that in a revision of their submission form, because that is indeed the way they implement it.
So that's how we would do it?
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
So have we had enough discussion that we're going to be able to, is everybody comfortable that they're going to be able to vote on the issue for this set of whether we want a single composite or whether we want a composite plus individual measures?
Right. I think so. Let me ask one more question. In terms of the workload, as time goes on with reviewing each of the individual measures, I guess that would be one advantage of just having the composite. Is it possible to say if the composite is looked at and endorsed again, that means automatically that the individual components would be re-endorsed if one were to vote for both?
Well, at that point, that's really not something the steering committee can and deal with at this point in time. NQF has guidance on evaluation of composite measures, which is actually going to undergo review in the near future, and that's where that kind of a issue can be dealt with. Right now, the requirement is that the parts are evaluated.
So this is Dion again. So right now we're talking about just the antiplatelet agents group, not the others that are on the list. Is that right?
Correct.
And so with the you probably know this, just lost track of it. So the
it's easy. Don't worry. It's easy to lose track.
So if when we talk about a composite, are we talking about only the three, 067, 068, and 0631, or are we also talking about the related measures?
No. Okay. The only composite we're talking about is the Minnesota Community Measure 0076. It's an all-or-none composite measure that has four components.
Got it. I'm sorry. Okay.
Okay, so that's the only composite there is. The committee at our meeting identified that as a competing measure with five other measures,
okay,
which address blood pressure, antithrombotics, and lipids.
Okay.
So, and Dion, it's very confusing, but I mean, I think we want to try to separate this into two separate issues. One is, are you going to approve the composite as well as individual measures?
Right.
And then the second step is, then you got to look at the individual measures and say, okay, they're all competing. Do you approve all of them?
Right.
Or do you choose one or whatever? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
So I think if people are comfortable that we've had enough discussion about the composite versus individual, now we should proceed to the second stage, which is the individual competing measures for antiplatelet agents. And if you have the right document open in front of you, it's 0067, 0068, and 0631, although 0631, is that the one that's not up for review
right
now?
That's not up, right.
That's the one that's not up for review right now, but in that we can still provide guidance regarding that issue. So let me just lead off by pointing out that 0067 is about coronary artery disease. So from the standpoint of the evidence base, it's extremely strong. This is in essence secondary prevention. Most people would label secondary prevention. Ischemic vascular disease is a broader population. So, for example, it includes stroke as a condition, for which Mary can comment, but I think the evidence is also strong. But it also includes, for example, peripheral vascular disease, for which most people would say, I think currently the evidence is not so strong.
This is Marion, and you know, reviewing the PAD guidelines, it's really, aspirin is in there mentioned in the context of preventing coronary disease and stroke, basically because you have a population with atherosclerotic disease.
So, Mary, do you want to comment on the strength of the data for cerebrovascular disease?
Well, the updated guidelines, both primary prevention and secondary prevention, I'll just stick with secondary prevention. Certainly the guidelines have been recently revised and continue to support that, both intracranial ischemic disease and carotid ischemic disease.
So, other comments from the committee regarding these competing measures, and I think at this point it's very, very important for the committee to consider the lengthy comments from ACCF, AHA, and PCPI in their letter, the same letter we talked about earlier. The most lengthy comments are reserved for the issue of competing measures. They express, I think, a number of important concerns about how competing measures should be evaluated, and they're very concerned that the breadth of the population is getting too much weight in the guidance with respect to how to evaluate competing measures, and that there's no place in the guidance where the process used to develop the measures is factored in.
This is a philosophic issue to a certain extent. The question is, do you use a rifle or a howitzer, you know?
I like that one.
And the benefit of having a rifle is that you can identify a narrow problem and do something about it. But the, as I think others know as well or better than I, the benefit of the composite is that it looks more towards overall care and the episode of care, because you can do absolutely wonderfully with antiplatelet therapy and still have everybody dying of hypertension. So that unless you're trying to juggle six or seven different measures and all at the same time, that can be hard to do. And if I think that the philosophic part is that the folks who wrote the letter may be more concerned with individual action items. And I think both have a place myself.
And this is Karen Pace. I just wanted to mention these comments were also submitted in response to the public comment period we had on the competing measures guidance, and the CSAC is reviewing this. But just in terms of clarifying the position about preferring broad-based measures, you know, the caveat to that is if it's supported by the evidence. So I think there's some mention in here about the evidence being different, and that's a perfect example of why you would need different measures if the evidence is really different for different patient populations. So just to kind of keep that in the forefront as well. And in terms of the looking at the measure developer's process, it's really not part of our evaluation criteria. I guess our criteria are based on the assumption that developers that follow best practices in measure development will be able to demonstrate that they meet the various criteria, but we don't specifically look at the process of their development separately.
And that's the concern they're raising. In essence, they're saying you should, or
that's
NQF,
right.
NQF
that's
should.
Right. That is, and it's something that the CSAC will respond
okay.
to.
So we're struggling with this, I sense, in the absence of any comments. And that's, I think, expected, because they were the first group to really deal with this competing measures question. I would point out, in addition to the points we've outlined already, that the two measures that are under our, you know, purview right now, 0067 and 0068, also differ in the sense that 0067 allows for a variety of exclusions, mm-hmm. which are really not feasible under 068.
And one other question, although it's not one of the ones that I guess is up for review. When they refer to is obviously there's some administrative data, but with some clinical data, it's a third one over the 0631.
Yeah.
I know that's not up for review right now. I guess it's not. It's endorsed.
Right.
But what is that referring to? So there's some pharmacy data? Is that what it is?
Yeah. Well, it can include encounter data, pharmacy data, and also actually the way this is implemented, you can include elements from EHRs or PHRs.
So it's not only was it prescribed, it was it filled, or the pharmacy part of it, or are they?
If they're using pharmacy, which is not typical for aspirin, it will be filled. But if it's just aspirin usage, it may just be reflected in the EHR or PHR.
So it's kind of a different kind of thing than the other measures.
Well, yeah, and that's one of the challenges as people look at and say, oh, there are too many measures. They're all a little bit different. Mm-hmm. If they were totally identical, then hopefully they wouldn't exist as different measures. But the challenge for us is to decide whether we're going to continue to endorse all of them.
This is Mary, and when I look at these, one from Pinnacle, one from administrative data, one from pharmacy data, it's having similar measures that are tailored to a specific data collection system, which is really problematic in trying to really evaluate what we want to measure.
Mary, this is Reva. I think that the committee is echoing comments we hear from a lot of membership, and we've got several competing issues. It's well known that different data platforms do generate some slightly different measures, and given where we are, perhaps it's okay in the interim until we reach a common data platform. On the other hand, it just adds to a huge list of measures that's confusing and redundant to a lot of audiences. So those two tensions are very real.
Yeah.
And I think, for example, to go back to the exclusion question, my favorite example these days, which I cite whenever I can because I think it demonstrates the problem, is we've got millions of Americans with coronary disease, and we've got millions of Americans with atrial fibrillation and a need for chronic warfarin therapy. Now, we therefore have millions of Americans who happen to have both. And do you just willy-nilly say, well, everybody needs warfarin and aspirin? The evidence on that point is incredibly scant, yet there are millions of Americans. And so in this case, one of these measures excludes all the people on warfarin, and the other does not.
This is Dion again. Maybe this is backtracking, but relative to the composite versus individual measures conversation, the measures are different enough. The numerator statements are different enough that they don't feel competing to me in that sense, because the composite measure has as a numerator statement achievement of targets by the patient, whereas the individual measures look at the performance of the clinician, right? As I read the
right. Dan, I would just point out to you all that throughout both meetings, there were numerous comments about how many measures there were all about the same topic. So this was sort of a theme that the steering committee brought up. But in terms of the guidance that NQF provides in terms of determining whether there are competing measures, that's defined as measures that address the same concept for the measure focus, that would be the numerator, for the same target population.
Well, so maybe I'm being too strict in my interpretation, but to me, the composite measure numerator is not the same as, yes,
right.
It's the same content, broad content area, but the focus is different. So for me, it boils down to more this individual idea of if we care about clinician behavior, if we think there's some value in endorsing measures that are more focused on the clinician's behavior as the end product of the measure rather than how the patient ends up, then it's more, for me, a discussion about is it 06 0067 and 0068, are they competing?
Oh, I'm sorry if I didn't make that clear. That's where we are right now.
No, I know that's where you are, but I'm really responding to the guidance, the letter from the...
Yeah, oh, okay.
And that's my response, you know, to look at them, that it's not just, you know, composite or not, which is, I think, part of what they talk about. It's also this other piece about what is the intent, what is the focus in the first place.
In which patients are we, you know, I don't know, you know, that coronary disease alone... You know, it would really, or does ischemic vascular disease, you know, drugs may not be identical, right? Let me see on those two columns. So how do we can't necessarily say they should be, maybe the target groups are not identical. One is more diffuse vascular disease, or
right.
other than coronary disease can be included. So the data, and, you know, again, I'm not the one to know all the data for peripheral vascular disease, but I don't claim to be, but I would imagine that, you know, there may be some differences in data there. So I don't think they are the same target population, and the question would be, you know, I don't know that we could assume that we can just put all the coronary disease under, you know, there may be some very specific things for coronary disease that would apply. So between those two, you know, if we can't really evaluate all the other ones,
right,
you know.
This Karen Pace again, and just a couple points. But I think the reason the question is raised is if they have the same numerator giving antiplatelet therapy, and I don't have, and you're doing it for two different, the first question is, do you need two separate measures if you're measuring the exact same thing in two different populations? So that's the question, should they be combined? And if the evidence is different, then wouldn't the numerators be different or the exclusions different, which you've been talking about? And we're not saying that they have to be the same. That is the question before the steering committee, what your guide, your recommendation is.
So I think part of our challenge here is whether there's any more discussion that's going to basically make people, because Riva, help me. I think this part of the ballot is going to be, do we,
right,
having made a decision, composite versus composite plus individual,
right,
the second stage is going to be, do we continue to endorse both,
right,
0067 and 0068, or just 0067 or just 0068?
Right, and that's the way I've drafted the ballot right now, is there's a first question that is, do you, go for the composite only, so you have that as a separate vote. But then, because we don't know the outcome of that vote, then these measures, the two antiplatelet and the two lipid measures, are there for you to vote whether you recommend or not.
But I would still think that it's, you know, again, thinking about this out loud, but I almost think that maybe they should be still both there, because the data may be stronger, for example, if they're grouped together, then, you know, you're not going to know, the data may be stronger, I don't know if this is true, for coronary disease than it is for other types of peripheral vascular disease, and wouldn't you want to know them separately and then be able to have physicians know, you know, maybe where there is a gap in care in one or the other? I don't know. The more I think about it, since they're not the same, they're not, I know it's the same numerator in terms of antithrombotic therapy, but if it's different diseases, I don't know that it makes sense to me to combine them.
Well, we're not combining them. We're just picking
one or the other. Or, I mean, just eliminating.
We're just, you know, because the pushback from primary care docs in particular is, I don't understand this. Why are there so many different measures?
Yeah.
But then that would mean, I would, by implying that you'd eliminate 0067 because it's more inclusive for ischemic vascular disease, is what I think. If you...
Right. Well, and as I've tried to indicate, it's not that simple, because 0068 says if you're on Coumadin for atrial fibrillation, you're supposed to still be on antiplatelet therapy.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's no exclusion.
Right, so they'd have to modify. So it would have to be modified. Yeah.
Well, we can't say that. I mean, well, they can't do that. It's an administrative measure. They don't have the capacity to do that.
Yeah, good point.
See, that's the...
Yeah, and the administrative part of it,
yeah,
you know, isn't. Mm-hmm.
All right, so I think we've discussed this one enough. I'm sure now we're going to move on to the next little area, which is lipid control. That's the next set of tables. And again, we have the PCPI measure versus the NCQA measure that deal with, in one case, coronary artery disease. In the other case, again, a broader population, including ischemic vascular disease. But they're both about lipid control. And one basically, there are, you know, more differences here, right? I mean, one has to be at 100 during the most recent screening, whereas the other one basically takes into account the potential problems in terms of side effects and problems with statins. One considers allergies, intolerance, other medical reasons, patient's preference not to take them, but that's not in the administrative measure. Has everybody found the right table?
And is it all three that we consider the first?
It's again 0074 and 0075.
Okay, but 0076 isn't under consideration.
Well, it's the same question. Remember, if we choose the composite, these first individual columns, if we say the composite only, these first two individual columns are dead.
Mm. Okay.
So we're saying if we say both the composite and individual measures, then how do we choose or do we choose between 0074 and 0075?
Well, in the same, not surprisingly, I guess, because it's the same group. The composite measure is about the achievement, the patient's achievement, right, of outcomes, as opposed to the clinical behavior for the other two. Is that right?
Well, 0075 is about the outcome.
Oh, it is about the outcome.
This one has another nuance, and
right.
075 has the outcome.
Right.
And it's process and outcome for 0074.
Right.
Wow. And it's a different subgroups of coronary disease patients. This isn't so easy.
It's kind of noteworthy that the steering committee evaluations were substantially different for the much broader spread for 75.
Comments? Questions, because in essence, at this point, we want to make sure that everybody is reasonably comfortable balloting on this issue.
So to me, I mean, the one, I don't know, the 7.5 having specific MI, CABG, PCI, to me, you know, coronary disease obviously covers that, so it's kind of all-inclusive. In the first one, and so it doesn't have the administrative. This is, has an administrative component.
I'm sorry. Somebody else was trying to say something. I heard a voice.
Yes, this is Carol.
Carol, you're very. It sounds like you're in Outer Mongolia. So we need you a little louder, if possible.
In your hotel room. Is that Outer Mongolia?
Speak up if you can.
Okay, I will. My question is, I'm confused. Do we have to choose between those two measures if we endorse the composite plus the individual?
No. We can say the ballot will have on it, presuming that if we choose just composite, not composite plus individuals, this is all moot.
Okay.
If we choose composite plus individuals, then the second part of the ballot becomes relevant, and it will say 0074 and 0075, or 0074 or 0075.
Okay. And is this all moot when the new guidelines come out for composite measures?
No.
Okay. Thank you.
They won't be that different.
Hi, this is Deborah. If we went with 74 instead of 75, what would we lose?
The other patients who are part of the broader population. So it would, let's see if I can get this right. I have to go to the denominator statement. It's got to be, again, the vascular disease, but not coronary disease patients. I think that's correct.
Oh, and I guess that because the 74 is limited to a 12-month period and 75 is... I guess 75 is even shorter, I'm not sure.
75 has a longer time frame, so there is some difference there, but I think it's primarily in the patients.
Right.
Five includes patients with cerebrovascular and peripheral arterial disease,
right?
Which 74 does not.
Right. So, I'm trying to look down in the table. The table's pretty complicated, but right, that's correct. So, for example, it specifically says occlusion or stenosis of precerebral arteries, atherosclerosis of the renal arteries, atherosclerosis of native arteries of the extremities. Chronic total occlusion of an artery of the extremities. And there's an entry that says cardiovascular disease. I presume that's cerebral vascular disease, but maybe I've got it wrong.
At least the shotgun.
Right. The shotgun versus the rifle again.
Or the howitzer.
But 76 has already included the larger ischemic vascular disease population.
This is Kathy. On 0074, it applies also in skilled nursing facilities, and 75 does not. And is that an important distinction?
Seventy-six does not either. Or does it? No, it does not.
I presume that's by virtue of the data collection mechanism. Mm-hmm. Additional questions? Are people going to be comfortable? I know Reva and the staff are going to word all these ballots extraordinarily carefully so they're obvious.
Well, the one thing I would tell everybody is if indeed you decide that you cannot differentiate or cannot make a choice between them, and you can explain why that there are as a need for both measures, that's fine, but please include those explanations because we will need to present that information. There will certainly be an opportunity for the public and NQF membership to comment on your decisions, and you'll get to see that feedback. And that may prompt another set of discussions.
So just in, this is Deanne again, just in my head in terms of thinking about the ballot, it seems to me that the what we've been discussing is side-to-side comparisons of who's included and who's excluded, but that's one decision point that we might consider. Another is whether it's just process, just outcome, or some combination. That's another decision point we might consider. And I'm asking, I'm just thinking out loud here, that where the patients are captured, so the setting question that was just brought up might be another point. Is that that's what you mean in terms of explanations, if we were to focus in, that you'd want us to explain those kinds of...
Do you feel there's a benefit for having both, a value for having both? Because we have to convey that explanation
right.
to the audience. Because I will remind you that one of the common themes that this committee talked about during both of your meetings were, there are 6 measures for aspirin use. There are 5 measures for ACE and ARB use. That is something we hear a lot in various audiences. So how do we resolve that? As you can see, it's difficult.
Reva, this is Karen Kamenik. Are you open to comments?
Ray?
Sure.
Oh, hi, this is Karen Kamenik. I'm with the PCPI. I just wanted to offer, regarding the communication aspect, and I certainly sympathize with what you just said, Reva, just to offer that, you know, we're also trying to communicate for providers, whatever level of analysis we look at, the individual physician or the group or the ACO, we're trying to encourage people to select a portfolio of measures that best address their patient population. And so in communicating about these, instead of just listing here are all the measures regarding antiplatelet therapy, you know, to try to explain that if you are primarily treating a patient population of CAD patients, then in your portfolio of measures that you manage for those patients for which we're holding you accountable, we'd want to include antiplatelet therapy. So I'm just offering that another way to kind of look about if communication is the issue is to remember that we want measures whereby we can advise those who we're holding accountable what measures should go into their portfolio of measures by which we will hold them accountable for a patient population that's relevant to them. Just wanted to offer that thought.
And just a comment in return is the tension that against the stakeholders that are looking for a focused, standardized set of measures so that there aren't redundancies within the portfolio. Very definitely another tension.
Okay, I think we've probably had enough discussion about this.
Right.
And I think, Reva, you can provide some guidance here, but I think we probably need to make sure we, at this point, make sure there aren't additional public comments.
Right. I've got 15 minutes, and I'd like to perhaps, Ray, if at all possible, try and do the phase two competing, mainly because I think I can shorten this one really quickly.
All right.
Okay. On page 3 of the next page of the same memo on competing related measures, we talk about 3 pairs of competing measures. First measure of each of the pairs is a measure that you all have evaluated and recommended, although 1525 is a measure that there were some outstanding issues. Most of which the measure developer has responded in accordance with the desires of the committee. But the second measure, the 0624, 0610, and 0615, are very similar measures that are based on administrative or claims data. And in late-breaking news, the CSAC met 2 days ago and reviewed the guidance on competing measures, realizing the struggle you all are going through. And one of the things they wanted to emphasize was they fully support maintaining multiple measures that are similar, particularly if one of them is based on claims or administrative data. So you're not being asked to act on those measures, but the only question is it reasonable to have multiple measures addressing the same topic.
I guess I would just ask a question to step back first. So it's based on what administrative data, and do we feel that data is accurate? So,
you're not evaluating those measures. They're based on basically encounters and pharmacy data.
So Reva, you're saying those measures are not up for review?
No, they're not. They are just provided for context because they are in the portfolio.
But I still think pharmacy data, I mean, we're measuring, it's great. I mean, it's the ultimate way to measure it, but, it's measuring something different than, what the doctor documented in the chart that they recommended. That's also getting into the patient compliance side of things.
Correct.
So, I mean, that's great, but that's also, there's other factors there that would need to be, assessed when we're looking at different, controlling for different differences between groups there.
Right.
But
the question before you is, I think, much more simple.
So, Reva, given that new guidance, I'm not actually sure in my mind what the question is.
Well, the question is simply, it almost makes this moot, but because these measures do address similar, they're essentially very similar, does the committee want to maintain their recommendations for the three that were evaluated, knowing the others do exist? We have to explain that we know that there are similar measures, and the reason for recommending multiple measures is the differences in data platform. If the committee agrees with that, that's all we have to do.
Let me just give you a little more context about the CSAC discussion, and it's really in context of this move towards wanting clinical data, clinical measures to come from clinical data from electronic health records. And obviously we're not to that point of those being widely available. And the idea is that in this period of transition, which some think will be longer than shorter, that there may be a rationale to have measures of the same thing that you can measure using different data platforms.
Right. No, this is Snow. You just said what I was going to say. I think that the time will come for these to go away, but we're not there yet.
Right. And so we don't want to, if choosing only one measure greatly diminishes how many entities you can have performance measurement for, we really haven't accomplished anything.
In the bigger sense, we've lost something, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and I agree with that.
Are there any members of the committee who feel that we should, in fact, do away with one of these? Or that there... is there an argument, given what Reva's told us about CSAC and the enunciated argument that we're in a transition time, is there an argument to take more drastic action at this time? I'm just asking whether somebody sees an argument.
Okay. All right. I have to. Do we have the 0624 measure in that? Do we have the second ones only because does that also include... with AFib, whether or not dabigatran is in there,
That's been corrected.
Okay.
That's been corrected.
It's in both.
The developer in response to our feedback. So, I mean, the 1525, I don't know about 0624, but
that's
not up for review right now.
Yeah. I guess I'm always a little hesitant when if it's administrative data only. And I have to look up that one. I don't even think we have it, probably, do we?
No, because it's not. Because
it's not up for review.
It's
so
in the side-by-side, so the
yes,
it is. Okay. So I guess I'm always a little hesitant with just if it's just administrative data and how that's obtained. I guess that's from the pharmacy for prescription refill.
Right.
What page is that on, or how do we find that one?
It's if you just keep going down the... competing measures.
Yeah,
it's bookmarked for competing measures, and then you got to scroll through the antiplatelet, the lipid, and eventually you'll come to a narrower page. And the narrower page is 0624 versus 1525.
We wouldn't be able to do anything with that anyway, so I guess...
All we could do is say we recommend, for example, that one of these be... We could recommend right now that we're not going to endorse 1-2-5-2-5 because now we see that there's a previous competing measure, or we could give the advice that we think 064 should go away, but we can't actually decide that. That's what we could do.
Right. All right, so we definitely need 1-15-25.
And our support for the ones that we did review was pretty substantial.
Correct.
Right.
Could we not also recommend that in your criteria for evaluating competing measures, that if it is based on claims data or different data platforms, it should be considered as important?
Yeah.
That's not in your competing measure guidance.
We're working on that now. As Reva said, the CSAC just discussed it the other day, and so we're...
So you'll add that?
Right.
Okay.
So the numerator on the 0624, obviously, because it wasn't made when dabigatran was available, does not include dabigatran, so clearly the 1525 would be superior in that.
Well, I've checked with the developer. They're adding it.
Okay, so the ballot is going to just basically, for these, say we reviewed 1525. There's a separate administrative measure, 0624, on the same subject, and it's going to ask whether we should continue both.
Correct.
Are people comfortable with that? And do you have more questions about that? Or are you going to be comfortable voting on that?
The short answer for me is yes, but I think that in the preparation, it's kind of tricky because anyone who wasn't on this call is at risk for not having an understanding that the reason for even thinking of having such apparent redundancy is the difference in the data platforms and the fact that there's a real benefit to supporting that for a while longer.
Roger, to take care of that, we're going to be pulling together a summary of this conversation to go out with that ballot.
Fine.
And I think we should, as part of that process, and you've identified a key point, I believe, is to point out to people if, because they weren't on the call, they're not comfortable, they don't vote. They can just abstain.
Okay, we are getting close to time, so I do think we do need to do public comment.
Okay, public comment. Are there public comments?
Not hearing any. Going once, going twice. Okay, Ray needs to sign off absolutely at 5, and I just wanted to wrap things up. Frankly, not knowing how the results of the ballot are going to turn out, I think if we may need some follow-up based on that, but also the measures for inactive endorsement we have not acted on again, and so we will need to schedule another conference call so we'll have a chance to go over some of these issues again, particularly if the votes we do now raise additional issues.
Yeah, and hopefully we can lump that together with any follow-up from this call plus the inactive measures.
Correct.
All right, well, I thank everybody for their perseverance. This is challenging. And the agenda was obviously challenging. We realized that from the start. So I don't think we view it as a failure that we didn't get to the inactive measures question. We made a decision to put that last in case we didn't. So thank you, everybody, for their time and their perseverance. This is difficult enough, but doing it by phone, I think, is even more difficult. We will rely on the staff to get the ballot out in due course.
Have a nice flight.
Thanks.
Flight, Brett.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye,
guys.
Bye-bye.